Let's continue our study in the book of Esther, shall we? So let's open up to Esther. And many of you have been asking or wondering, well, when did Mari get home? Well, that's a long story. And I'm going to tell you some pieces of it, but I'm going to save the whole story for her to tell, because you guys all know that I had my story, right, with the Albatross Hotel, okay? And Mari didn't, stay at the Albatross, trust me. But she did have an interesting experience, of which I'm going to tell you some of the pieces of that tonight, you know, at the end, because you'll see why it'll make sense. So as we look in, we got our introduction into the book of Esther last week, and we made it through chapter 1. And so chapter 1 of the book of Esther is really an amazing thing. I asked you guys a question. And so for some of you that weren't here last week, let me re-ask it because it'll apply to us tonight. Do you believe that God is all-knowing? Yes or no? How many of you believe that? Let me see your hands, okay? That way I can tell if you're with me. How many of you believe that God is all-powerful? Okay, so there's nothing that he doesn't know, and there is nothing that he can't do. Are you with me on that? So then, with that knowledge in our own minds and our hearts, do you believe that God can be trusted? Okay, now that presents to us the big problem. Why don't we trust him? Okay, why? I mean, we do, and honestly, we're going to learn that. We're going to learn to trust God, and you're going to learn it over and over. We are going to learn it over and over and over and over until the day that you take your last breath, and then we're going to enter into the kingdom of heaven, and you're going to trust him completely because you're going to see him face to face. But learning the part of, is God trustworthy? Can he be trusted? That's not a problem. The problem on our end is we tend to want to trust ourselves. We want to trust in what we can see. We want to trust in what we feel oftentimes. And honestly, there are different ways where we're going to learn this lesson. I'm learning it continually. I had to learn it again this week in new and different ways, and I'll share that with you here in a minute. And so this book is all about seeing the hand of God at work. And it should, after we finish with the book of Esther, I hope that we're going to be able to look at this book and say, wow, can God be trusted or what? So we learned last week that this is taking place during the Medo-Persian Empire's rule. So Babylon was, the Babylonian Empire came in to Jerusalem, sacked the city, took people captive on a few waves. They did this. We'll get into that timing. They come in, bring all of these Jews out of Israel and into Babylon. Left many of them there to, you know, they left the sick, the elderly, the wounded. They left them there. But the vast majority of Jews in Babylon. The Medo-Persian Empire rises to strength. They conquer the Babylonian Empire, just as God had predicted through the book of Daniel, when Daniel saw the great image, you know, the head of gold was the Babylonian Empire, the arm, the chest, and the arms are the Medo-Persian Empire. And so that empire is what is ruling. The Babylonians were not nice to the Jews. They were not friendly to the Jews whatsoever. The Medo-Persians were very friendly. As soon as Cyrus the king took over, he released them to go back home, said, hey, you guys go back home. In fact, I'll give you all of your stuff that Nebuchadnezzar stockpiled in the great temple here. I'll give it to you. Take it back home. Rebuild your temple. I'll give you the stuff to do it. So during that reign, Cyrus comes and goes, and now we have another king. Darius came and went, and he had a son named Xerxes. He named himself Xerxes the Great. His name is Ahasuerus in the Hebrew. And he comes upon the scene, a Persian emperor, and We learned a little bit about him, that he was a very, he was the kind of guy that made snap decisions, didn't think things through, got a bad temper. He's a friend of the Jews, but yet at the same time, he's a very egocentric guy, and he's got a problem with alcohol, honestly. So he has this big party where he's trying to gain support. I shared some things with you that was going on behind the scenes that isn't talked about in the book of Esther. That behind the scenes, Ahasuerus is planning an assault on Greece because Greece is rising to power. Ultimately, Greece will conquer the Medo-Persians. And so Ahasuerus sees these guys as a potential threat, goes to war, wants to go to war with them. He's trying to gain support for a great battle. He wants to do a big naval battle with these guys and throws a big party, invites all of his, buddies and whatnot and saying, hey, from all of the different regions all around saying, guys, we need to do this. Are you with me? And so they're all drunk and he decides to bring Queen Vashti out, his prized bride. He's got this huge harem, as we're going to find out tonight. But he has one queen, wants her to come out, parade herself around. He wants to show her off in front of the boys. She, being a great woman of honor, says, no, I'm not going to do that. She refuses. All of these group of men are sitting there saying, wow, if you can't control your wife, can you control an army? And if you don't do something, then we're in big trouble. It gets exaggerated by, as men often do. They say, well, you better deal with that woman or else word's going to get all over and all of our wives are going to rebel against us and they're going to become just like her. And so let's make a treaty. Let's put something in writing that wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. Yes, let's do that. And so they put this big thing out. And I'm sure that when word came into each city, we're going to have a town meeting. Here's the new document. All wives will honor their husbands. I'm sure that for all of the women of the cities, they went, whatever. And but it went out, all right? So now, just for FYI, in between, as I shared with you, in between the end of chapter 1 and the kind of the beginning of chapter 2, there's a time span. Almost 4 years have come and gone between chapter 1 and chapter 2. He's gone out against the Greeks. He got spanked. He comes back. His naval ships were sacked. The Grecian Empire made a fool out of Ahasuerus. And so he comes back into town, and instead of this reigning hero, conquering hero, he comes back kind of with his tail between his legs. He kind of comes back and sneaks back into town, so to speak. So then, all of a sudden, he realizes something. So let's find out what he realizes, all right? So you're in chapter 2, look at verse 1. After these things, after what things? The things of chapter 1 plus the stuff that I told you that fill in the blank. When the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided. So he came back, he was mad that he got beat. He was mad that he got spanked by the Greeks. And, he's come to his senses. Look what he remembers. He remembered Vashti and what she had done, where she became, they changed her name from Vashti to Smashti because she ruined his party. You guys remember that whole story. And what had been decreed against her. Remember, he made a decree that she would be dethroned, she would be taken away from being the queen, he remembers this. So he's home. His tail's between his legs. He's kind of feeling like, doggone it, man. I wish I had a woman with me to share what I've been going through. So he comes home. And he's got a harem. Listen to me. He's got this huge harem. The harem operates. All he has to do was tell the eunuch that's in charge of the harem, pick one out, bring her to my quarters. He sleeps with a different girl whenever he wants to. So the guy has got all the women he could ever want, but he doesn't have a woman. And there's a big difference. There's a big difference between lust and love, isn't there? He doesn't have the woman that he wants to share his heart with, that he can spend that time with, the his main squeeze, so to speak. He realizes, you know, I got all these girls and none of them really mean anything to me. And so he realizes, man, I wish I had Queen Vashti. What did I do? Maybe, he's probably thinking, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I should rethink this thing. Maybe I should figure out a way to get out of this. Why we think that is, look what happens. Then the king's servants who attended him said, whoa, 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 we have an idea. Instead of bringing Vashti back in, obviously, let's do something. Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of the kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, that's his, remember, his winter palace, into the women's quarters, under the custody of, let's see, Hege is how you pronounce this guy's name, Hege, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women. So the harem was being overlooked by a eunuch. Now, how would that happen? It would be a guy that had been castrated, interestingly enough, so that the king could say, I need a guy, I need a man that's strong enough to protect these girls, to watch over them, but also not man enough to do anything with them. And so Hege is the guy that's in charge of it. Now, I want you to see a couple of things here. In this story, we're going to see God at work behind the scenes, doing absolutely amazing things behind the scenes. Right off the bat, we see a group of guys that appear like, well, you know, these guys, instead of just finding a way to bring Vashti back in, when he says, man, I remember Vashti. What did I do? These guys said, whoa, 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 time out. We can't bring Vashti back in here. You issued a decree. You can't go against your word. That would be disastrous. Plus, we can't have Vashti back in there. We can't have her back in there, honestly. As much of a woman as honor as she was, you know the story that's going to unravel. We need somebody other than Vashti back into that place. We need a good, strong Jew in there. So these guys are actually working in the hands of God for a purpose behind the scenes they don't even know. So let's read it, and we'll come back, and I'll show you all of the different things that are happening here. So they say, hey, Hege, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, let beauty preparations be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. So let's give them a spa treatment. By the way, you guys, this is like a year-long treatment, by the way. And so let's have extreme makeovers and let's just do this. But obviously, they're not going to need too much makeover because they're going to pick out the most beautiful women in all of the provinces. So this thing pleased the king, and so he did so. Now, let me explain something to you, that when we have fun with the book of Esther and you get to use your noisemakers and all that, there are certain pieces of this that we leave out. One of the pieces that we leave out, I want you to understand, we call it the Miss Shushan contest, but in a beauty contest, you have women who choose this. They volunteer for it. They compete for this. This is not a beauty contest like we have fun with it, okay? This is a different kind of a beauty contest. This is a contest that is entered not voluntarily, but by force. So these group of men go out into each of the cities. They knock on doors. Do you have a daughter here that's never been with a man? Yes, we do. Bring her to the front. They look at her. They make a judgment right there on the scene. If she's beautiful, she goes away. You can imagine during this particular time, nobody's wearing makeup. The girls ain't wearing makeup, right? And this is one of those times that if you were a beautiful woman, you're bummed that you're beautiful. Nope, you're beautiful. You're coming with us. No, I don't want to leave. You're coming with us. So they were forced to leave. They were forced to be a part of something that they did not choose. Now, in a beauty contest, after it's all done, the winners win a prize and the losers go home. But you were in a contest. So you can always say, I was Miss So-and-so, you know, Miss California, at one point in my life. In this contest, no girls go home. So even the losers become a part of the king's harem. What does that mean? That means they become a part of this large group of women that are governed by eunuchs. So, yes, they live in a palace, but they might spend one night with the king, and that's it. So on a certain night, he might say, bring me a young girl. He brings her. They bring her to his chambers. He sleeps with her. She goes back, and that may be the last romance she has for the rest of her life. She doesn't ever get to marry because she is a part. And I mean, when they get old, they are turned loose. But during the years of their beauty, they are bound to the palace, to a life of boredom. You can imagine how boring that would be. And just hanging around with, you know, the girls all day long. And you can't really leave and do anything. Yes, you're fed. Yes, you're taken care of. But you can never marry. And that may be the only time that you ever experience intimacy. And what kind of intimacy is that when you just know you're just a thing that just was used and now put back into the stable, so to speak? So this isn't a beauty contest that the girls are saying, yes, I can't wait. I hope to be a part of this. This is one that they were dragged from their houses and made to be a part of this, Esther included. So the winner, and there will only be one, there are no runners-up, there's no second place, third place. There's one queen. All the rest of them go into the king's harem stable, so to speak. So that adds a little bit of intrigue to our story, doesn't it? And so, you know, this is kind of a radical thing where these girls lead basically an empty life. You know, their desires of having their own weddings and all that dashed to pieces just because of the whim of a king who decides, I got spanked in Greece, so now I want something. I need women. Okay, well, let's have a beauty contest. Yeah, I like it. You didn't ever ask the girls about this. This is all self-centered, self-absorbed. You see this picture. That makes sense? So now, let's meet our characters. So we know already King Ahasuerus. We already know him. So the thing pleased the king, and so he did. And so in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, and the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. So Mordecai, his family's taken out, and he's actually born in captivity. So is Esther, by the way. So there are some people that would say to you, oh, well, Mordecai was taken out. Well, if that is true, then that would put him at about 129 years old in this story. I think he would be way too old to be a guy that is going to carry on the job that he's doing. So in all reality, it was probably his father that was taken out, or even his grandfather, and he is born in the area of Babylon. He's born in the captivity. And so, but understand, the Medo-Persians came in and they are friends. And so Mordecai is one of our heroes of our story. Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter. So what would that make her to him? Cousins, okay? For she had neither father nor mother. Now we're going to learn the name of her father here in a little bit, but nothing is told really of how her parents died, but they died when she was just a baby, and so, or just a young girl. So now the young woman was lovely and beautiful, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So let's take a look at a couple of things. Her Hebrew name is Hadassah, and it literally means myrtle. Now, we have myrtle trees in Ramona. They get those big white flowers, right? So it's very interesting that here she is, and they change her name in Babylon to Esther, and that means star. So isn't it interesting that her name is Myrtle, and those put out flowers that kind of look like stars, and so I don't know if maybe it was her nickname. Hey, Myrtle, well, actually, you know, you look like this flower on a myrtle tree that looks like a star. So, how she got her name, we don't know. But it's very interesting that her Hebrew name is Hadassah, and it means myrtle, which I think those flowers are beautiful. And so her parents are killed. Her uncle, her cousin, takes her in, adopts her as his own, and raises her with the rest of his family. Now, it says that she was lovely and beautiful. Those words almost seem to be the same word. But the word beautiful means beautiful, a picture of beauty. The word lovely means she has a figure. So she has a beautiful figure. So physically, she is very attractive, as well as she has a beautiful face. So how in the world you can tell all of that, the way those people dressed back then, I'll leave that for your imagination, okay? But she has, if you look up those words in the Hebrew, lovely means of a figure, beautiful. So, but I'm going to tell you also that there is something else that she has. She has character. She has personality. Because we're going to learn things about her that just a nice figure and a beautiful face don't get you, all right? So it was, verse 8, when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel. So you see the words, it doesn't say when many women volunteered. No, they were gathered, they were herded together under the custody of Haggai, that Esther was also taken. You see these words that are used in the Hebrew, translated, to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. It doesn't sound like a volunteer thing. Are you getting the picture? Now, the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So it can't just be, I mean, understand, you guys, they've taken every beautiful woman from the whole area. So it's not just that she was more beautiful than all of them, even though that's possible. It can't be that she just be that she has the best figure out of all of them, although that's possible. There's something about her that's different. There's something about her character. There's something about her personality. There's something about her nature that made her special, or made her different than all the rest of them that were there. You with me? And because this guy Haggai, who's in charge of all these women, plus the women that were there before this contest. So he's got all these women, and there was something about Esther that he says, now that girl's special. You with me? So, more pieces of the puzzle you'll see when we come back to it. Then, 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from among the king's palace. And he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. So he's elevating her, he's giving her servants, he's giving her special treatment because of her, not only her beauty, but I believe because of her character. And we'll see her character really develop later on. Now, Esther, verse 10, had not revealed her people or her family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. So, what is her people? She's Jewish. What is her family? She comes from a family of Hebrews. Mordecai the Jew. A Jew named Mordecai. So, She is a Jew living in a Gentile area. I'm going to paint a little picture here because we'll talk about it. Jew living in and amongst Gentiles in what was a captivity, but they're not in captivity anymore. They were all free to go. Mordecai, Esther, many of the Jews chose to stay there. They were doing pretty good. I mean, under the Persian Empire, they were given a lot of freedom. They had businesses. They had families. They, you know, they were involved in school, and, you know, they played soccer and all of that kind of stuff, you know. So, you know, we don't want to leave. We're doing okay here. So Mordecai chose to stay. He's raised Esther. She chooses to stay. But they're Jews living in a Gentile area. And he says, don't tell them that you're Jewish. Just kind of keep that under your hat. We'll just keep that between me and you. And when was that taking place? Maybe when they were coming to take her captive. And he told her, shh, just keep this under our hat right now. I'm going to present a scenario to you here in just a second. So every day, Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. So obviously he was trying to keep informed. He probably asked people, did you see a girl in there named Esther? Yes. How's she doing? Oh, she got moved into a separate quarter. Really? Yeah, she got seven different ones. Heike really has taken a liking to her. Awesome. So he's out there trying to get as much information. I mean, he's a loving father, right? So, verse 12. Each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus. Excuse me, you guys. That tickles back. After she had completed 12 months of preparation, according to the regulations for the women, for thus were the days of their preparation apportioned. Six. My voice is changing. You guys didn't know I was 14. So 6 months with oil of myrrh. So girls, how would you like this? Every day for 6 months, you get a rub down with oil. 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. So for the next 6 months, it's beauty treatments, makeup, massages with perfume. Could you girls handle that for 1 year? Would that be okay? You could do that? Yeah, all right. So thus prepared, each young woman went to the king. And she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king's house again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. So if she was someone special and he remembered her name, then she might get one more opportunity. But for the most of them, one chance. So, each one of these girls could say, they'd say, okay, hey, it's your turn tonight. Little Susie, it's your opportunity to go in and be with the king. What do you want? And she would have her choice of what perfume she wanted to wear and what jewelry she could choose from, the wardrobes that were provided. You could wear whatever you want. You could take whatever you want, and you get to go present yourself to the king. So each of these girls would make their own decision. So it's very important that we catch this, okay? So they would choose what they think the king would like. And each one of them got their own chance. We don't know how long this went before it came to Esther's turn. And so now, verse 15, we get to meet our heroine. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, that's her father's name who had died. And interestingly enough, her dad's name was Possessor of Might. Isn't that interesting? And he was the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter. to go into the king. So we just learn about Esther. We've just met her dad who had passed away, Mordecai, who is the Jew who has taken her under his wing and raised her. So she requested nothing but what Haggai the eunuch, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So when it comes turn for Esther's turn, they come in and say, Esther, what you choose your perfume, choose your jewelry, choose the wardrobe, you get to pick whatever you want. Esther wisely says, Haggai, you know the king better than I do. What does he like? She's a smart cookie. Not only beautiful, she's a smart girl. So Haggai says, you've chosen wisely, grasshopper. So let me show you. And if you guys have seen the movie Esther, it's pretty cool. You know, she just chooses a Star of David to wear, and you know, and very plain, very simple. But instead of trying to razzle dazzle the king, and I kind of wonder if that's true, instead of trying to razzle dazzle him with her clothing and her perfume and overwhelm him with all of that, she goes in very simple, and it intrigues the king. So whether that all happened, we don't know. But she was smart enough to not choose for herself. She was smart enough to ask somebody who knew the king. So Esther, verse 16, was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all the other women. Now, does that mean that he loved her like, oh, it was love at first sight? Actually, no. I think it's an unfortunate translation. I think if somebody is anybody here reading out of a New American Standard? Or Mar, yours is out of the New Living. What does the New Living say? Right there in verse 17, the king. Okay. Anybody else say something different? What's your say, bro? Attracted. That really is a better translation. The king was attracted to her more than all the rest of them. So there was something about Esther that attracted his attention more than all the rest of them. Okay. And she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head, and he made her queen instead of Vashti. So instead of allowing the eunuch to do that, instead of allowing one of his others to do that, he says, no, I will take this. And he puts the queen. He makes a pronouncement. Here she is, Miss Shushan. She's the winner of the contest, right? So what's interesting, she finds favor in the sight of Haggai the eunuch. Then, obviously, with all these women, and you girls could probably imagine that in a contest something like this, it's probably a very catty, lots of drama going on behind the scenes that happens. And yet, even all the rest of the girls, wow, that girl's special. There's something different about her. We really like her, right? And now the king meets Esther, sees her, and is attracted to her more than all. He's so taken by her that he puts the royal crown. He goes and grabs it, and he takes care of it. He says, I'm not letting you out of my sight. Boom. He puts the crown on her head. He announces it. And so then the king made a great feast, and he called it the Feast of Esther, for all his officials and his servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces, and he gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. So he's so excited that he's got this new queen, he's got this new girl that really has made a difference in his life. He says, I want everyone in the whole kingdom to celebrate with me that I've got this beautiful new queen. And she's a great woman of character and all of that kind of stuff. So, pretty cool. So, here we have the placement and if we just read it for what it is, it's a very interesting story. It's a love story, kind of. We have this man who is empty and he's lonely and he's a man of lust and power and wealth, and yet he's also a lonely man who desires the love of one woman, even though he's not going to give up his harem. So Esther knows that she's not going to be the only one. And so here we see a woman, Jewish, hiding her Jewish faith, hiding her Jewish heritage, taken, just like all the rest of the girls of the area, placed into a position, and she wins the king's heart. And you would think, wow, this is an amazing story. Not so fast. Let's finish this chapter, and I want to come back and show you some things and hopefully give us an application. So, when virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now, Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. So we see a very diligent girl. And you guys understand, she's probably, some Bible scholars believe that she's probably in the neighborhood of 17, 18, 19, 20 years old in that neighborhood. And so she's an obedient girl, even though, you know, she was, you know, her parents were killed. So in those days, meanwhile, when Mordecai sat within the king's gate, I wonder if Esther pulled some strings with Haggai to get her her uncle a cool job here. I don't know, but he seems like a really smart guy too. Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now, the gate was a place. It wasn't just like we have a gate and it's just an entry place. These were more like courtyards. And courtyards literally meant courtyards. It's where court would take place. It's where decisions were made. It's where the king would put his counselors, that people would come and you would have a problem. So if I was a guy that sat in the king's gate, I would be sitting there and my expertise might be, in the area of marriage. And somebody else might have an expertise in the matters of legal things as far as lawsuits are concerned. And another one might have an expertise in some other area. So we would be there, appointed by the king and his court, to sit in the gate and give counsel to people. So a lot of activity took place in the gates or in the courtyards. And so Mordecai gets, he, even though he's a Jew, he is appointed. So he must have been smart, because even if there were strings pulled and you put him in there, if the guy's an idiot, then everybody's going to soon find out, right? So he's a smart guy too, as we're going to see. And so, in those days, while Mordecai sits within the king's gate, verse 21 says, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious. And they sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. We're not told why they were angry. We don't know if maybe it's because of the way that he's choosing his wife. We don't know if it's because they didn't get to be in charge of this, or Haggai was in charge and they weren't. You know, we don't know what drama took place behind the scenes. We just know that it does. So, verse 22, the matter became known to Mordecai. Mordecai overhears this. Oh, these guys are going to try to kill the king. So he tells Queen Esther. Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. So in other words, she says there's a man out there named Mordecai who has overheard these two men talking about killing you. And so when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. So these two guys will never try to kill the king ever again, okay? And it was, look at this, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So can I ask you a question? Mordecai saves king's life. Esther gives Mordecai all the credit. did Mordecai get an award here? Did he get a reward here? Did he get honorable mention? Kind of. His name gets written down in the book of the king. But nothing is given to Mordecai, at least right here. He doesn't get, a Medal of Honor. He doesn't get invited to dinner. Nothing happens here. So let's talk for a minute, okay? So let's discuss a couple of things. First of all, put your hand right here and turn to the right to the book of Isaiah. I want to show you something, and you can write this down somewhere in your Bible as a reference, okay? So we go over to the book of Isaiah. It's right in front of Jeremiah. And I want you to turn to chapter 46. There were many places that I could have taken you, but I think this is a cool one. Isaiah 46. And you know what? Let's pick it up at verse 8, okay? God speaking. Are you there yet? Okay? Remember this, God speaking through his prophet, and show yourselves men. Recall to mind, O you transgressors. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me. What can God do that makes him amazing? I can declare the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsels shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. So God has the ability to look down the corridor of time and see things that aren't even happening yet. As we talked about on Sunday, and we'll have to talk about it again because I messed up second service, God has the ability. He sees the beginning of time. He sees the end of time. And he exists outside of time and space, and he's able to watch this whole thing. So he knows what's going to happen down here. The amazing thing is that he's able to watch and see, and he knows exactly what's happening in your life right here tonight. And what's amazing is he knows what's going to happen to you next week. He knows what's going to happen to you next month. And he knows that now. He knows who you're going to bump into next month. He knows the things that are going to transpire in our lives. Isn't that crazy? Knowledge, that's too great for us to even comprehend. I can't even handle the time-space stuff, let alone that God, not only does he exist outside of time and space, but he knows what's going to happen in the future as if it's right now. And he knew it before you were even born. He knew you were going to be born before you were born. He knew you were going to be born even before your parents were born and before they even met each other. Isn't that crazy? Did he know who was going to be president? I'm wondering about that. So the point is this. Listen carefully. God is in control. And we can trust him. And we need to learn to trust him. I want to show you what's happening here in this book that is absolutely amazing. As we know, there's a guy whose name is Haman, who's not even in our story yet. He is an enemy of the Jews, and his desire, he's a satanic puppet who's going to come upon the scene, and his desire is to destroy and to annihilate all the Jews. Purpose, to prevent the Messiah from coming, ultimately. That's a whole other Bible study when we get there, but I want you to see something here. So God, and understand, Satan doesn't have that kind of knowledge. Satan can't see into the future, and he's not all-powerful. But God allows this all to take place, and the big question is why? Maybe we'll answer that. I'll give you my best attempt. So God is looking, and God sees, here's Haman. He's going to try and destroy all of my people. He wants to kill the Jews. Now, could God have prevented Haman from being born? Could have. Could he have allowed a skateboard accident and he end up, paralyzed from the neck down? Kill him. He could have gotten ran over by an elephant or something like that. Okay. All of these things could happen, right? God could have allowed all those things. But he doesn't stop that from happening. Interesting. So God knows this as he's standing outside of time and space and he's looking at this whole scene. He goes, this guy's going to try and destroy all of my people. He's trying to prevent Jesus. He's trying to prevent you from coming into the world. So God says, well, this ought to be fun. So he picks out two Jews that decided not to go home. And here they are in a land of Gentiles. And I pose an interesting question to you. He says, Mordecai says, don't tell them we're Jews. Now, don't you find that to be interesting? Jews stand out wherever they are. Hitler was able to find them. The Jews, just by their kosher lifestyle, the kosher diets, their desire to keep the commandments, their willingness to not marry outside the faith, and all of those kind of things. Okay? So how is it that they were able to hide this from everyone? Interesting thing to ponder. Could it be that they were compromisers? Maybe. Could it be that that this all went down so quick that all of a sudden the brute squads came, they started pounding on doors, and before that could all happen, these outsiders came. Mordecai heard about it, says, don't tell them we're Jews. Keep that under your hat. They'll kill you. Possibly. We don't really know how this happened. All we do know is God chose to use it all anyway. In God's amazing sovereign power, he said, Rob, don't worry about all of that. I can use whoever I want to use whenever I want to use them. I can even use a pagan king. I can use pagan counselors to prevent Vashti from coming back into power, who Vashti would have been probably a friend of Haman and an enemy of the Jews. And he says, nope, 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 we need to remove Vashti out of the picture here, and I need to put another person in there. And so God, knowing this, allows Esther to be born, allows her family to be taken out of the picture to where she's raised by Mordecai, the Jew, we're told. So he taught her in the things of Judaism. So these guys say, no, we don't want to have that. Let's have a beauty contest. Let's go get these girls. God in his amazing sovereignty, I don't think he approves of any of this stuff, but God is able to use these things in the lives of people. And he says, here we go. This girl's going to come. She's special. I've created her. I've fashioned her in her mother's womb, just like Daniel was special, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were special. Living in pagan cultures, godly Jewish men in pagan cultures that were raised up, not just because they were handsome or beautiful, but because they had character and they had wisdom. So God says, yes, here she is. I prepared this girl. I've got Mordecai set. Mordecai, I'm going to get you a job right in the king's gate. I'm going to allow you to hear about a plot to kill the king. But Mordecai, don't take it personal that you don't get a reward right now, or that you don't get awarded. You just be cool. Esther rises to power. She becomes the queen of all. God's got these little pieces all in place. All of these little parts of the puzzle that come together. That the king looks at her and sees her. That suddenly Haggai, who's looking at hundreds of beautiful women that have come from all over the kingdom, and Esther's the one that he says, wow, you're special. I've got my... Esther, I'll show you what to wear in front of the king. All of these pieces of a puzzle. Does it seem like to you that God has gone through a whole lot of trouble when he could have just allowed Haman to be stepped on by an elephant? Isn't that crazy? And yet, the main lesson for many people in this story is, will you trust me? So God is teaching people to trust him in the midst of all of this stuff that's going on. Could God have done this, in my opinion, a much easier way? Just, whoop, there was a terrible accident today. An elephant stumbled, fell over on a guy named Haman. Game over, right? But God is at work doing something. The question is, why? Is he teaching us to trust him? Absolutely. But can I give you my other opinion that, and I'm open to hear whatever other ones that you may have. God is in the business of teaching all of us just how much He loves us and how much He cares for us. And if this would have just come and gone with a tragic elephant accident, then would Esther ever know the love of God? Would the Jews ever know just how special they are when God creates an entire plan that you guys haven't even seen yet? Would Mordecai be able to stand and say, "Wow, this is amazing that you're in that place for such a time as this"? Would they know the love of God for them? They would have never known had God not allowed all this to take place. You see what I'm saying? So God allows things in your life and in my life to teach us to trust Him. Why? To show us how much He loves us. To just show us, "Rob, I love you." So in this, we see that God knows the beginning from the end. He sees all of these things that take place. And God can use whatever He wants to use for even a pagan Gentile king if He wants to do that. So I told you I would tell you Mari's story. I'm going to only tell you bits of the story. You've got to hear the rest of it from her. So it's all set. She's been gone for 2 months. And we got her a different hotel. Okay, you guys know that. If you don't know that story, come and talk to me and I'll tell you that story. So she spends the night in the hotel, shows up. Her flight's supposed to leave at 10:30. She shows up 8 o'clock, I think. Did you get there at 8 or earlier? 8 o'clock. And looks around, and I may butcher the story, so you got to listen to her. But she gets up to the counter, and they say, "Your flight's been canceled." "What? What do you mean my flight's been canceled?" "Yeah, it's not going to leave now till 2 o'clock, I think they originally said, right? Till 2 o'clock. Yeah, military time over there. So Mari goes, "What?" So here's what happened. In Germany, the air traffic controllers are negotiating a new contract. So on Monday night, they have a big meeting, and they don't settle the contract, but they made progress. So as a sign of solidarity, they had a walkout Tuesday morning when Mari's supposed to catch your fly. So Germany is shut down. The airports are shut down. I think I read something like 20,000 flights coming in, going out, all of that kind of stuff, from 4 in the morning till 1 in the afternoon, shut down. Right? So Mari's hanging out at the airport. I get a phone call at 12:45 on my cell phone from Delta saying, "You know, this has been changed." And I'm going, "What?" So I jump up, go to the internet, type in her flight number. Sure enough, delayed, 2 o'clock departure. I call. So then about that time, Mari Skypes me from the airport. So now it's after midnight. She starts saying, "Yeah, Rob, something's going on with the air traffic controllers." I type that in, Google it real quick, find out exactly what's happening. I go, "This is crazy, man. This is crazy." She's already there, as you guys know, with a broken heart. She's left our daughter and our little grandson. So we then touch base through the rest of the evening while she's sitting at the airport until 3:30 when she finally leaves, 5 hours and something later. So the original flight, connecting flight in Detroit, that she was supposed to take from Detroit to San Diego, that's kiss that one goodbye. So there's one flight left on Tuesday evening that's coming to San Diego. It leaves at 7:30 from Detroit. I'm following this thing where she finally gets on the airplane. She's, you know, "Okay, I'm on. We're leaving." It's 3:30 in the afternoon, projected time of arrival, 6:30 in Detroit. She's got to go through customs, all this kind of stuff. I'm going, "Ain't no way she's going to make this. There's no way." So start praying. Robert, congratulations, Robert. They just had their little grandson just this past week too, by the way, you know. And so now Robert knows how easy it is to fall in love. Okay. So So Robert calls, hey, is your woman on home yet? And all this guy, I've had my grandson. I said, dude, she's her next flight. We could have trouble. And he goes, we're praying. So many people, many of you that knew, you know, you're praying. So I'm praying, Lord. God help her, God help her. There's no way. Is that a prayer of faith? I mean, I know she can outrun everybody else on the airplane, but, I mean, you got to get through customs, and that takes time, right? So she finally lands in Detroit. I had already sent her a text message saying, honey, you got to have to run. She gets to customs. She calls me up. She goes, it's a huge line. I don't know if I'm going to make this. I'm in trouble. I'm praying, Lord, you know, don't let her get stuck in Detroit. We got to find her a hotel. Oh, Lord. And all the while, God's saying, Rob, do you trust me? Mari, do you trust me? Yes, Lord, we trust you. But I don't want her staying in Detroit tonight. I want her to get home, right? And she's not going to make it. There's no way this is going to happen. So God's saying, do you trust me? Yes, Lord, I trust you. But she's not going to make it. A great man of faith. So she gets through part one of customs, because you go through two parts. You get your little paper that you have to sign. They check your passport, blah, blah, blah. And then you go get your suitcase. You take that, re-go through security, recheck your suitcases. So in between that, she calls me and says, Rob, I don't know what gate I'm supposed to be at. I don't want to stop and look at a monitor. I want to run, so just tell me what gate. And I said, I can find that out for you. You know, so it's all text messaging. So I go up, type in the number of her next flight that leaves Detroit 7:30, thinking there's no way she's going to make it. Bring it up on the line, flight delayed. 2 hours. So I send her a message back saying, don't run. It's delayed for 2 hours. You got it. It's okay. Well, it got delayed even longer than that because she didn't get home till after midnight. So she had been up for 27 hours or some crazy thing like that. But here's the deal, you guys. What happened? The flight crew was coming from Philadelphia, to be on this plane in Detroit that was going to come out to San Diego. Bad weather in Philadelphia caused that flight to be late, which caused her flight to be late, which caused her to not have to spend the night in Detroit, which taught us God can be trusted. So me and Josh came to the conclusion that two entire airplanes and all those people were late and missed all of their flights because God loves his little Hadassah over here so much. You know? See, isn't that crazy? But do you see what God, and I look at that and say, Lord, why didn't you just leave this thing alone and let her, the air traffic controllers could have gone to work, elephant could have fell on the negotiator, right? But God goes through all of this trouble. And if we will just have eyes to see it, if we can just step back and go, wow. And it seems like a whole lot of trouble just to teach the two of us that God's saying, I got you covered, guys. What are you freaking out? Why are you so stressed out? Did I not tell you that I got you? And only to find out that flights are late and all this kind of stuff. And so we learned once again that God loves us. But then you step back and say, Lord, why did you let all of that happen? I want you to learn to trust me, number one. And I want you to see how much I love you. I'll go through all of this stuff just to show you that I exist and that I care about what's happening in your life right now. Of all the people in the world, of all the things happening in the world, do you realize that God knows you're sitting right here, right now? And he loves you. He loves you passionately. And he wants to teach you how to trust him. And that's going to be a lesson that we're going to learn over and over and over and over again until the time we see him face to face. And the book of Esther is all about watching the hand of God before things even happen. God's already at work. Let me ask you a question. When I made this reservation, what was it, 4 or 5 months ago, probably 6 months ago, do you think God knew that this walkout was going to take place on that Tuesday morning when she was supposed to catch her flight? Or did God go, oh, my goodness, we're going to have to fix this now. Uh-oh. Well, I tell you what, throw a storm into Philadelphia real quick. Do you think God reacts. He knew. It's all a part of the plan of God teaching us how to trust him. When I saw delayed, I started laughing. I'm going, Lord, how many times are you going to have to deal with me teaching me how that you can be trusted? You know, how many times you got to show me how you're faithful? And he's going to show us. Why? Because he loves us. Jesus, we thank you so much for your amazing truth, for your amazing power, for your amazing love for us. And tonight, Lord, as we ponder these things, and Lord, I'm looking at a room full of people that each one of them have their own story of you being at work in their life. And so, God, teach us to trust you. Forgive us, Lord, when we don't. And Lord, we thank you that you're willing to prove your love for us and to us over and over again. So we give you the night tonight, Lord. A night that you knew we would be together in this room. Jesus, thank you for Hadassah. Thank you for Mordecai. Thank you for these two that, for whatever reason, you chose to use them. And we're grateful. In Jesus' name, amen.